BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. In this Moneybox podcast, would you buy a house without even visiting it? The strange new world of virtual tours. New rules which should help people pay for insurance in these difficult times. And how can entrepreneurs who are excluded from all government grants help themselves? But first, the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, has revealed that 7.5 million people are now furloughed at home under the coronavirus job retention scheme. The government programme gives their employers a grant to cover 80% of their pay, up to £2,500 per month. But Moneybox has had dozens of emails and tweets from people claiming the scheme is being abused by employers who are taking the money but breaking the rules about how it's used. In effect, a fraud on taxpayers. Dan Whitworth has been investigating. He's with us now. And what have you found out, Dan?
Well, Paul, we've had lots of people get in touch to say their employers have, as you say, been abusing the scheme. And I'm going to go through three of the most common examples we've been getting. Now, for obvious reasons, we've changed people's names to try to protect their identities. So first up is Steve. Now, he works for a small company and says he's been asked to work virtually every day since being put on furlough, something that is strictly against the rules. Now, this isn't his voice, but they are his words.
My employers have explained they know they're breaking the rules because they have said, technically, you're not supposed to be working, but we need you in for the good of the company whilst you're on furlough. So they've used phrases like that to try and guilt trip me to go in. They keep reiterating the fact they know it's wrong, but that they need me in for the good of the company. They've just got a complete disregard of the rules. There are people who've just missed out on furlough and who are desperate for the money. And then you've got my employer who's abusing the system. Basically, if I go in whilst on furlough, the government's paying my wage, so they're getting free labour, and that just does not sit right with me. And I feel sorry for the people who can't actually get the furlough money they desperately need.
Well, Dan, Steve's quite clear there. His employer knows it's breaking the rules of the job retention scheme. What are people in his position supposed to do?
Well, HMRC is the branch of government which is in charge of the scheme, and it's encouraging people who know the system's being abused to report that abuse. Now, the cost of the scheme is roughly as much each month as we spend on the NHS and has now been extended to run until October, although employers will be asked to step in from August and pay some of the costs. Now, it's very simple to ask people to get in touch when they know abuse is taking place, but that's not something Steve says he'd be able to do.
If I do report them to HMRC, like HMRC are encouraging people to do, then they'll know it's me because it's a very small company and they'll know instantly I've reported them. Also, if HMRC decide they want to take the furlough money back, if they issue big fines, that'll hit the company and make it even harder for me to keep my job. If it hits the company in the pocket, it will hit me in the pocket. I feel there's a real risk to my job and my livelihood. I've been saving, trying to save up enough for a deposit on a house. At the moment, I'm just saving as much as I possibly can. I don't know if I'm going to be in a job in a week's time or a month's time, so it's quite scary. So I'm doing my best to try to grab a hold of my finances, just in case it happens. So I am quite scared, to be honest.
Dan, that's quite a testimony, isn't it? What other problems have people been raising?
Yes, we've had another person get in touch who we're going to call Susie. Now, she says her employer is forcing people to take holiday one day for every week they're on furlough. Now, Susie only got told about this a few days ago, so some of that holiday is going to be taken retrospectively and some of it will be taken going forward. Now, Susie says she's worried it could mean she's not left with any holiday left to take when she needs it for childcare over the summer. And our third example is from someone who emailed saying their niece, who works in a bar, was put on furlough straight away but has struggled to get paid any of the money. Now, they can't contact her boss and she's hugely out of pocket.
How likely is it that HMRC will go after employers who abuse the scheme?
OK, so that's a difficult one. As far as HMRC is concerned, it's very black and white, though. So I spoke to employment lawyer John Skelly at Baker Skelly Law Firm. Now, he told me HMRC has made it clear that it retains the right to retrospectively audit all aspects of a claim, and if companies haven't followed the rules, it could potentially claw back any monies paid, possibly with penalties and interest. Now, John also said a name and shame policy could be adopted by HMRC, which of course, would have reputational consequences for companies. And fraudulent claims could even constitute a criminal offence under the Fraud Act. Now, the maximum sentence at Crown Court for that is 10 years in prison for people like directors. But that, of course, Paul, would be the most severe penalty. Now, one final point John made was that given the sheer volume of applications, it's not clear if HMRC would have either A, the resource, or B, the appetite to back prosecutions of that nature.
And what's HMRC had to say to you about that?
It told us that the coronavirus job retention scheme is, quote, part of a collective national effort to protect jobs and is taxpayers' money. And it adds, fraudulent claims limit our ability to support people and deprive the NHS of essential funding. Now, it also told us it's had 795 reports of potential fraudulent claims from the public and that payments will be withheld if the claim is dishonest, biased or inaccurate. Now, if people are being furloughed, companies must pay their wages. And finally, it said, quote, we won't hesitate to take criminal action in the most serious cases.
Thanks very much, Dan. Well, let's talk now to Sarah Chilton. She's a partner at Lawyers CM Murray, who specialises in employment law. Sarah Chilton, we heard from Steve. He's been asked to work while he's been furloughed. The firm knows it's wrong, but says it needs him. How strict are these rules? What can and can't you do?
So you cannot have an employee working while they're furloughed. The rules are very clear about that. So employees are able to undertake training and they're able to undertake volunteer work, but they cannot do any work which would be revenue generating.
And they can't do voluntary work that would help the company, is that right? It's got to be voluntary work in the community or something like that.
Exactly. So it's difficult to see in most companies what that would look like. And I think in most cases, voluntary work won't happen because it won't comply with the furlough scheme.
But strangely, the employee themselves can go and work for someone else while they're on
furlough.
Yes,
they can. They can. They can take another job. If they have two jobs already, they could be furloughed from one and not from the other. Mm. So they are free to go and seek other work. They just can't work for the employer that's furloughed them.
Now, Steve, like many, many people, doesn't work for a big company. And he's worried if he reports what his employers are doing, they'd know it was him and he'd lose his job.
So he is protected by whistleblower legislation. So if he was to make a report, what he'd effectively be doing is reporting a breach of the law. And as a result of that, he becomes a whistleblower and he's protected them from suffering a detriment. So that would include, you know, being disciplined or docking pay and also from dismissal. But I appreciate that that's still a difficult position for him to be in, because if he is then terminated, he would have to exercise those rights potentially in an employment tribunal.
Yes, I mean, he wanted to keep his job and doesn't really want to take that risk. I don't think you can understand his point of view, and that indeed is why he wouldn't have his voice used on the radio. And what about Susie? Now, Susie was the other one, another one that Dan mentioned. She's being told she has to take holiday, and some of that holiday, she's being told, has to be taken retrospectively, like the last 2 or 3 weeks. Is that possible?
So the retrospective issue is slightly easier. So an employer can make an employee take annual leave, but they need to give them notice of that. And they need to give them notice, which is twice the length of the leave. So it follows that you cannot retrospectively order an employee to take holiday because you cannot have complied with those notice requirements.
If you wanted someone to say, look, you've got to take a week's leave as part of your furlough, you have to give them 2 weeks' notice.
Exactly that. There is another issue, which is whether or not, in fact, if you're asking someone to take leave during furlough, they can really use that leave for holiday, which is rest, relaxation and leisure time. And I think if we look back to the last 6 weeks of lockdown, there may be arguments that you couldn't do that. I think going forward, it may be possible for someone to actually rest and relax a bit more.
Yes, we've had an email from Elaine about that. She said, I have a diagnosed anxiety disorder, which makes staying indoors very difficult. Mm. I asked the question of my employer, you know, this isn't a holiday. It's not going to be good for me. And she hasn't had a reply. What can she do? Can she enforce that?
Again, she could potentially enforce it. It's a very unclear area because it will be very fact sensitive. So it is a risk to try and enforce that by, say, refusing to go on holiday, because she may be left in a position whereby she is disciplined, but she technically may have a right to not be put on holiday.
And even if you are given proper notice and you have said that week or those few days are holiday, what does the employer have to pay you?
full pay. So they don't pay you your 80% or your capped out furlough pay. They pay you your normal pay. And so they can still reclaim the furlough grant from the government, but they have to top it up.
You have to get your full pay for that time. Another email we've had, this was from Maureen about her daughter-in-law who's furloughed and is towards the end of her pregnancy, about to go on maternity leave. She's going to be made redundant and the company want to base her redundancy on the furlough pay, not her actual salary, which we're told is double the furlough pay. Can they do that?
So they should be preserving her redundancy rights. They should be the same as if she wasn't furloughed. The only thing I'd say about that is she should check whether or not she's entered into any contractual variation to her pay that may affect her redundancy pay calculation. But I would think in most circumstances she should be entitled to her redundancy pay based on her full pay.
And finally, some people are worried that, and we heard this earlier from Steve, that if they do report somebody and they get prosecuted by HMRC, is the employee doing anything wrong for doing the work that they shouldn't be doing?
Technically speaking, potentially, because they know that it's a crime and a fraud. But I would think in the circumstances, what they would be able to do is report that to HMRC anonymously, particularly in a bigger employer, and then they're sort of discharging that obligation. But I would imagine HMRC will be much more worried about the employers who are forcing employees to do that.
Sarah Chilton, thanks very much. And let us know your experience as a furlough. Email or tweet us at moneybox@bbc.co.uk. And I have to say, most employers, of course, are obeying the law. Clive tweeted, "My employer said I'm not allowed to work and he's turned off remote access, so I can't." Now, talking of remote access, would you buy a house without even visiting it? Virtual viewing of property is recommended in new guidance from the government, which opened up the property market in England this week. Moneybox has been told that in Scotland, some surveyors will be back at work next week. Virtual tours are also happening there. Now, they can be pre-recorded or live on a smartphone, but can you really make your biggest financial purchase based on a video tour you watch on a little screen? Endia Scopani did. She's recently completed the purchase of a terrace house in Bonnyrigg, just outside Edinburgh, through Dean's solicitors and estate agents.
So it worked really well, actually. So I did two virtual tours. So I have something to kind of compare with. So the first virtual tour, it was the owner of the house that basically we started from the entrance and we sort of went all over the house. And on the second tour, it was again the same. The owner of the house gave me a little bit of history of the house, who has lived there. And then again, starting from the entrance, just sort of walking through the house as you would probably do in a physical viewing.
And you were able to get a real feel for the property then?
Yes, I didn't expect that. But when I did the first virtual viewing, we kind of hung up the phone and I was like, didn't really feel that one. Whilst with the other house, I was so in love with it, I just had to go for it.
It is a huge investment though, isn't it? Did you feel comfortable making a decision on the back of just a tour around looking in a smartphone?
Well, yes. So before I actually did the virtual viewings, I requested a home report just to make sure that the house is structurally sound and it doesn't need any immediate repairs. So I only viewed houses that basically need a cosmetic updating, if that makes sense.
Yes. I mean, those home reports are something that you have in Scotland, I know, but we don't have in England. So that's obviously a great help. How did you know the seller wasn't hiding things from you, though, that you might not have liked?
Yeah, I have been thinking about that. And then I thought, but what is the difference? Because if they wanted to hide something, they would hide it on a physical viewing as well. I'm not an expert in houses. I wouldn't even know what to look for, even if I would be there. Because before I went on to doing virtual viewings, I did do some physical viewings as well. And it didn't really go that different. I asked them to show me the boiler. I got to see the boiler and things like that. But I wouldn't know what to look out for to make sure somebody's not scamming me.
And afterwards, what happened? Did you make a decision right away? And then what happened about buying it?
Yeah, so I I fell in love with the second house instantly. So I just kind of sent an email to my solicitor and I said, let's just make an offer. And in fact, there was somebody else making an offer as well. So it was a bit of a fight, but I won it.
So would you recommend virtual viewing for other people who are thinking about buying a home?
Absolutely. One of the things I was thinking after I have done my virtual viewing, and I don't know why I thought, but what if somebody from London wants to move to Edinburgh, let's say? That's a great way to at least get a feel for it. I feel like that would save time and energy of people who are looking to relocate to the other side of the country and just be like, you know, I'm not feeling this house, so I'm not going to spend all that money on flights or trains and things just to go a house that I'm not feeling.
So you're spending over £140,000 for a house that you haven't been inside.
Yes.
And you're happy with that?
Yes, I think the main thing, obviously, it's different in England, but the main thing for me was the home report. The home report was excellent. So even if there are some minor things that needs doing, I'm prepared for it. I know that the house needs updating. I knew that from the pictures. I knew it from the home report, and I knew it from the virtual viewing. It's an outdated house, so I will have to put a bit of work into it.
When are you moving in?
Well, the aim is to move in on the 19th of June if, obviously, lockdown is lifted and land registries open and things like that.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with it, NDS Kapani. Well, I played that interview to Mark Haywood. He's chief executive of the National Association of Estate Agents, Property Mark.
I think virtual viewings are very much of the future, and the government guidance that was issued on Wednesday recommends that in the first instance consumers conduct a virtual viewing, and that way they can actually decide whether or not they want to do a physical viewing, so that minimises the number of physical viewings out there. I think what people have to remember is, but just like a physical viewing, a virtual viewing must show the property warts and all, because under the CPR, Consumer Protection Regulations, an omission is an offence.
Yeah, yes, but that's a bit of a worry, isn't it? I mean, a video, it sort of feels a bit like a PR video for the property. You want something where you can ask questions and say, you know, open that cupboard, show me the boiler. It's got to be as close as being there as possible.
You also need the person that's conducting the viewing to show you what's on the other side of the garden fence and not just highlighting the good bits.
Now, you mentioned the government guidance. That, of course, relates to England because the property market was opened last Wednesday in England. What about the rest of the UK?
Scotland, there is a meeting on Wednesday to look at COVID house moves and a working group, but I don't think Scotland is probably going to come out before the 28th of May, and that will come out in stages. The home report was mentioned earlier, and of course that's right at the beginning of a house marketing exercise. So at the moment, no surveyor has been able to visit properties to create a home report.
For the benefit of people who aren't in Scotland, explain what a home report is and what value it is. Obviously, Endear thought it was very crucial.
The home report in Scotland is prepared before the property goes on the market. All the legal information that you'll need is within it. There is a condition report, so you can see what will need doing. There's also a value attached to it, which will help when you come to get a loan. So it's a huge amount of upfront information that you can make a decision on, even whether you want to view the property before going any further.
Because Wales produced some new guidance yesterday about COVID, but nothing, no mention at all about the property market. Nothing new in Northern Ireland. So a very different picture in different parts of the UK.
Yes, very much. Wales holding back at the moment, no indication of when. Northern Ireland, I think, are releasing garden centres and a couple of other sectors on Monday. But again, no mention of when the property market will be released.
In this 11-page guidance for England, and let's imagine that in a few weeks' time, much the same will be going on everywhere. It certainly isn't back to normal, is it?
No, not at all. There's very strict protocol regarding viewing a house, involving social distancing, PPE, the number of people that will view a house, the time of viewing should take. So that's got to be managed very much, rather than having an open house and everybody piles into a property and has a look together. It's now going to be people probably two to three from the same household. I think children will be discouraged from going on a viewing. All doors in the property will have to be left open during the viewing. The door handles, door knobs, work surfaces will have to be cleansed between viewings.
Am I perhaps a bit old-fashioned thinking that? Endia was quite happy, but I can't imagine moving to a place I hadn't physically been inside and, I don't know, I would say smelt. But you know what I mean? You get the feel of it, don't you?
Yeah, I think that feel, that ambience is important. And I think if you're making a huge long-term commitment, as you would do on buying a property, I think for peace of mind, you would want to physically see it.
And what about all the other parts of the puzzle that is a house move? Surveyors, removals. When will all this other stuff start up?
Well, the removal industry, British Association of Removers, issued their guidance last week. They're gearing up to carry out moves. Again, a very, very strict social distancing regime, asking only for one person to be in the property while the move takes place, asking people to pack all their own items. So they are there at the moment anticipating a spike because of the deals that were in the pipeline during lockdown.
What about the rental market? Because people must have come to the end of tenancies during this period.
Tenancies have come to an end and obviously have had to be extended. The tenant has a legal right to refuse entry to their property for people to view, if they are, particularly if they're concerned about infection or they are a vulnerable group. We know that any evictions, so to speak, are on hold for the time being, but I think there is going to be a large movement of properties where, if you think we've been locked down for probably 2 months, particularly over that watershed Easter moment when people will want to move, tenancies will coming to an end. So whilst the agent's property management side has been working during lockdown, the physical ability for new tenants to view properties, for old tenants to move out with lettings, a lot of these properties are in flatted developments, so there's issues on disinfectant of common parts, of lifts, doors, so a different set of difficulty, but certainly there will be activity very quickly once the lockdown is now easing.
Mark Haywood of Property Mark. Insurers are being told to allow customers to defer paying premiums if they're in temporary hardship caused by coronavirus, and they must also look at whether they can reduce the premiums for individuals, perhaps by changing the cover they have. New rules begin on Monday. Our reporter Dan is still with us. And Dan, not a complete surprise.
No, Paul. These changes were put forward by the Financial Conduct Authority, or the FCA, a couple of weeks ago, and it's now decided to go ahead with them, as you said, from Monday. Now, the new rules begin for what is called general insurance, so that's not life insurance or insurance with investments attached, but things like insuring your car, your home, your health, that sort of thing.
And what kind of changes can people expect?
Well, insurers are being told to see if they can offer lower premiums because customers are at a lower risk at the moment. For example, if they're driving fewer miles or none at all, so can their car insurance be cut? So far, only Admiral has offered an across-the-board £25 refund to its millions of motor insurance customers.
That's interesting, isn't it? And what if people are feeling the financial effects of all this and perhaps want to change the terms to make it cheaper?
Well, normally those changes come with an administrative fee, but now the regulator is telling insurers to waive those charges if people do want to make changes. The same applies for cancellation fees if customers want to end their policies. And one last point to make, Paul, if after all these changes, customers who pay in instalments, so for example, like every month, are still struggling to make those payments, well, the FCA says it will expect companies to grant deferrals unless it's not in the customer's best interest to do so. Now, those deferrals, well, they should last at least between 1 to 3 months or so. And all these changes, Paul, will be reviewed in 3 months' time and could be changed at that point if appropriate.
The government has committed billions of pounds to try to keep small businesses going while the coronavirus epidemic closes some and keeps customers away from those that are open. But there are gaps in the scheme. Let's talk now to Moneybox listener Hakeem Duckworth-Porter, founder and director of HDP Consulting. Hakeem Duckworth-Porter, what does your business do?
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me on the programme. It's a pleasure. And yeah, just very briefly, I run a business consultancy that essentially helps and advises other business leaders, especially young entrepreneurs, and how they can manage their cash flow, how they can have sort of multiple streams of revenue and income, and how I can also help them to manage any debts that they may have with utility companies or other creditors, which is especially quite difficult in these times.
Yeah, so sort of general advice on managing the finances of the business, which I'm sure many of them find very useful. And can you get any help yourself? I mentioned these billions of pounds the government spending. Any of it coming your way?
Well, actually, unfortunately not. And I'm in this strange, funny position where I'm advising a lot of my own clients on schemes that they can access, although a lot of these schemes I'm actually not eligible for myself. So I found myself I've become lately really well read on all of the help available. But because, for example, as a home-based business and an online business, we've been excluded from accessing the small business grant, I can't actually access that. People like us, we can't access that ourselves.
Because you don't pay rates, is that right? Or you're not relieved from rates?
That's right. We're not relieved from rates, but in my case, I'm 26 years old. You know, I don't come from, like many people, I come from fairly humble beginnings, having grown up on a estate in Brixton, and my parents haven't got loads of money to throw behind me. But at the same time, so that's why I found it quite difficult, although I'm managing to manage the business out of my rented flat, but at the same time as paying, you know, bills and rent like everybody else.
And what about things like the self-employment support, the income support scheme, and indeed the Corona job retention scheme?
So the job retention scheme is really helpful, but again, that's only for people who were already on their company's payroll, where even if it's their own company, by March 19th. In my case, I was running this business alongside working for another employer until March 11th, not knowing that we were about to walk into a lockdown and the biggest economic downturn since the 1700s or early 1800s.
So you're just the wrong side of the date. And I've had so many people contacting me to say that that is their problem too. It really is completely, it's arbitrary, but it's also completely definite, isn't it?
Yes, it is arbitrary and it is completely definite, because it definitely feels to me, you know, a bit unfair. You know, us, we may be home-based, we may be on the wrong side of the date, but we still pay corporation tax like everyone else. We collect VAT revenue for HMRC like everyone else. And that's why I think that the government should extend the grant scheme and other schemes to include something for us as well.
Yes, again, so many people say that, but we're paying taxes, we're not getting anything back. How are you managing then? What are you doing with your business?
So, it's a good question. And look, I think it's part of the entrepreneurial spirit, if you will, to adapt and to try and forge something of your own. And in my case, I know I speak to a lot of my clients, they're doing things just like that. In my case, what I've decided to do, so I've come up with a new service to clients where I help to negotiate on their behalf with their creditors and with their utility companies. And that's how I've chosen to adapt. However, you know, the problem with it is that I think, like a lot of us, I still feel like, okay, I'm throwing water overboard to prevent the ship from sinking, if you were. But it's not quite enough to ensure my survival, the business's survival. And it only takes a small wave or a significant wave, like maybe a client having a delayed invoice payment because they're facing financial difficulty too. Only takes that to potentially oversize the to wash the business away.
Well,
that's the difficulty we face.
What about loans? I mean, the bounce back loan, for example, you could get that perhaps.
Yeah, the bounce back loan sounds useful, and I'm thinking about getting it. But and it's great that they've done it. But even that as well, it's still debt as opposed to a grant. And I think it's good that that is available. But the reason why I think the grant should be available as well is just because they've helped other bigger businesses that we already sort of struggle to compete with. And I think that we should get something proportional to us too. And at the end of the day, you know, entrepreneurs, you know, we are the green shoots of the economy. You know, we all sort of contributing our blood, sweat and tears to force something of our own and to drive Britain's growth engine in employment, in living standards, in productivity. And entrepreneurs, young entrepreneurs especially, they could be, you know, the future sort of Richard Branson's, Lord Sugar's, etc. And we all start somewhere, and that's the stage of the journey that I'm at, and I want to make it further, but we've got to reach there first.
Now, you know what the government is and isn't going to do for you. What are your hopes for the future? How are you going to look to a future different from what you're expecting, but one that you sound very determined to make good?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And I think I ask myself that every day, and every day I'm slightly tweaking and adjusting the business. So in this case, in the future, what I hope to happen is I'm doing everything I can in my power to give myself that sort of short-term relief and short-term sort of managing of the finances and of the business to continue and then carry on as normal, depending on, you know, when we leave this lockdown. But the problem is that nobody knows.
No,
really, we don't know how we're going to exit. We don't know what the government will do to sort of reclaim some of the money we've spent. And that's why we need that short-term support. And I'm not asking for, say, like a handout, but something proportional that helps us, and that's proportional to what we also contribute to the economy.
Hakeem, thanks very much for saying all that. And don't go away, but listening to that is Elaine Clark. She's Managing Director of the online accounting practice, cheapaccounting.co.uk. Elaine Clark, your thoughts on Hakeem's situation? Have you come across a lot of young people like that?
Yes, unfortunately, when you put any set of rules in place, you can include quite a large number of people in those rules, but there are always going to be some people that have fallen through the cracks. And with obviously a Hakeem situation, new startup situation, and also generally directors of limited companies, they're finding themselves excluded from much of the help that is put in place. And it is very unfortunate that is the case.
Yes, I mean, you talk about cracks in the system, and they're yawning chasms in some cases. I mean, there are literally millions of people excluded, aren't there? Although many more millions who are getting help.
Yes, yes. And I think the issue has been is that obviously they've gone for what I call the low-hanging fruit, if I can use that term, to get support out there in the first place. So people who've got wage bills to pay, et cetera, because they've been able to implement those systems very, very quickly. The other ones would take longer to implement, and now maybe they've got their head above water with the self-employment scheme and the furlough scheme, although obviously, as we've heard today, that's being open to abuse. HMRC can now look at the people that they've excluded.
Well, we'll see if they do. How can people in Hakeem's position, and Hakeem in particular, what can they do to protect their incomes?
Well, I think one of the main things that I've seen in the recent weeks that I am sort of grabbing for a lot of people to cling on to is the bounce back loans. I think they're very, very important. And whilst recognising, yes, that is a loan, it is on very, very favourable terms. And I would say to use the opportunity of having some finance in the business to create opportunities, because I think for me, there's not a doubt in my mind that even if lockdown is eased, we could go back into this situation later on in the year, particularly in the winter months, etc. So we need to look at an economy where our restriction in movement becomes almost part of the norm until such time as we get an effective vaccine. So business as usual is changing.
Yes, and that does mean, doesn't it, that businesses have to adapt. They can't just
Absolutely.
Sit back with a loan and think, oh, it'll all be all right in 6 or 12 months, because
no,
it won't.
The loan, to my mind, the loan can be used to look at how do I take my business forward in what I'm terming, you know, and to quote a phrase, the new normal. Because what the services and offerings that you may have had in the past may not suit life going forward in at least the short, if not medium term. So it's super important. And as Hakeem has done to a certain extent, you know, look at refining one offering. But I think that potentially needs to go slightly further. And certainly in other people's views, and maybe use the grant for retraining, acquiring new skills, look at how you digitalise your offering, et cetera, as much and as possible as you can, recognising that some people still won't be able to do that.
Yes, and it is inevitable, isn't it? Some businesses will fail, others will thrive. Mm. It's a kind of blow to the whole sector, and like any sort of evolution, the fit ones will survive, and some won't, unfortunately, and there's not really much for them, is there?
No, and I think what lockdown has done is accelerated the failure of some businesses that were likely to fail anyway. And that is the harsh reality of it. And, you know, we know that many startup businesses do fail. We're also, obviously, over the last few years, seen in a downturn in retail. I think the lockdown has just accelerated that. We've got to think about how things can look in the future and create the opportunities and be entrepreneurial.
And Hakeem, final thoughts on what Elaine's been saying?
So I think that you made some really good points. I think the other thing as well, just speaking from the perspective of a startup and as someone who advises other startups, is that I think the government needs to appreciate that sometimes it takes new businesses a little while to sort of ramp up and get up to speed. And that is where an intervention in an economy like this, where we have you know, the biggest downturn in 300 years, and that's where that would be helpful. And you're right, though, some businesses are destined to fail. But likewise, there could be some businesses, and there will be some businesses that have the potential to really be game changers and really change our economy, lead Britain, make Britain a world leader in terms of digital and tech innovation. And if they don't get support soon, we might see them fail. And that would be a disservice and sad for everybody, whether they're the employers, the employees, or their families.
Hakeem Duckworth-Porter, thanks very much, and thanks to Elaine Clark. That's all from this Moneybox podcast. You can tell us what's concerning you about your finances in these strange times by emailing moneybox@bbc.co.uk or tweeting @Moneybox. We do read them all. Moneybox is live every Saturday at midday on Radio 4, and Moneybox Live, answering your questions, is on Wednesdays at 3 p.m. In today's podcast, the reporter was Dan Whitworth, studio team Rob Fanner and Russell Newlove, producer Charmaine Cozier, production coordinator Janet Staples, editor Emma Rippon. I'm Paul Lewis, and now, some silly jokes and funny sound effects.
Hello, I'm Greg Jenner. Usually I host the You're Dead to Me podcast and work on horrible histories, but while we're all cooped up indoors, I'm presenting a new podcast for the whole family. It's called Homeschool History, and every episode is a fun 15-minute guide to a fascinating historical subject. It's cheery, informative, and suitable for anyone who likes silly jokes and funny sound effects. And who doesn't? We'll have episodes on the Restoration, the Space Race, Charles Dickens, Florence Nightingale, Stone Age Britain, and plenty more. So that's Homeschool History with me, Greg Jenner, on BBC Sounds.